From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, it's time for Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. As it is this year, November 22nd, 1963 was a Friday. A Friday that some of us will never forget. For those who were not yet around, in many ways it may feel like you were there, thanks to the fact that the following weekends, and the next week's events were televised and, for the most part, available for viewing today. Today we are discussing President Kennedy's impact on America and on the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And to help out in our discussion, we have in the studio Carolyn DuPont. Carolyn is an assistant professor of history at Eastern Kentucky University, having done research specializing in race and religion in Mississippi from 1945 to 1975, an era that Kennedy was squarely in the middle of. Her book, Mississippi Praying, Southern White Evangelicals and the Civil Rights Movement, 1945 to 1975, was released in August of this year. Welcome, Carolyn DuPont.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
On the phone line, we have with us Jonathan Miller, co-founder of No Labels, a citizens movement of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, promoting a new politics of problem solving. Mr. Miller has been active in politics since college, forming Students for Gore during Gore's 1988 presidential campaign. Under the Clinton administration, Mr. Miller, a Democrat, served as deputy chief of staff at the U.S. Department of Energy. He was elected Kentucky State Treasurer from 1999 to 2007, was Secretary of Finance and Administration for Governor Steve Beshear from 2007 to 2011. And currently, Mr. Miller practices law at Frost Brown Todd in Lexington, Kentucky. He also runs a website, The Recovering Politician. Jonathan Miller, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Let's begin with Carolyn talking about the historical significance of the presidency of John F. Kennedy. And, of course, this week is the week observing the assassination. So we certainly want to talk about the assassination and encourage our listeners to talk about that. But we also want to focus a little bit on what Mr. Kennedy accomplished, what he stood for, what he continues to stand for. By the way, let me mention to our listeners that you can write to us with your personal stories about President Kennedy or the assassination to WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com, or send us a tweet using the hashtag WEKUEST. Again, that email, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com, and in a little bit we'll give you the phone number so you can call in. All right, Carolyn DuPont, the importance of Kennedy.
Sure. You mentioned that as a historian, my interests lie in both the civil rights movement and the history of religion in America, and I think President Kennedy's administration was pivotal in both of these, although they seem unrelated and the legacies are quite different. Of course, we identify President Kennedy very much with advances in civil rights. It is, of course, under his administration that the legislation that becomes the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was introduced. And Kennedy announced that legislation in June of 1963. But I think it's important to recognize that though Kennedy came to the presidency with a belief in racial equality and a commitment to racial equality, it was really more of an intellectual commitment to racial equality. It was not a profound moral and emotional commitment. He'd had very little experience with Black Americans, and he simply just didn't understand segregationist. He didn't understand what their concerns were. So he comes to the office believing in racial equality, but he doesn't really put forth much of an effort to do anything about it. And in that respect, he's really a lot like many white Americans. There was a poll in 1961 that revealed that 60% of white Americans supported the Supreme Court's 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision on the desegregation of public schools, but only 24% thought that things like what the Freedom Riders did, and of course the poll was taken in the middle of the Freedom Rides, were useful or appropriate. And Kennedy was certainly a person who didn't like the methods of many civil rights activists. He really wanted to keep the civil rights struggle in the courts. He wanted to keep it quiet. there's a notorious moment during his administration where a member of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, who happened also to be a Catholic priest, complained to Kennedy about the fact that the Alabama National Guard was all white. And Kennedy said, "Father, I may have to send the Alabama National Guard to Berlin tomorrow, and I don't want to do it in the midst of a revolution at home." So he's really concerned about keeping civil rights advancements very orderly. He doesn't want it in the street. He and his brother both want it in the courts. Now, the fact that he comes out so strongly in 1963 for civil rights legislation is because of what black Americans do that force him to do this. He had not, of his own initiative, championed civil rights legislation prior to that moment. So,
prior to the March on Washington?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, or really prior to that June 1963 mm-hmm. speech was just a little before the March on Washington. Uh-huh. So he, you know, I think that this is very important for us to keep in mind because we do identify him so strongly with civil rights. But it's really the efforts of black Americans that force him to be more proactive and more public. So I think that's the first way I think that we should understand his administration as pivotal. But if I may change subjects just a little bit and talk about religion, I think we should keep in mind, of course, we know that until that no one but a man has ever been president of the United States. Until the administration of Barack Obama, no one but a white man had ever been president of the United States. And until the election of John F. Kennedy, no one but a white Protestant male had ever been president of the United States. And while there are other things that happened during his administrations to broaden the acceptance of Catholics, American Catholics, into the American mainstream, certainly the presidency, the election of John F. Kennedy, helps that whole cause. And I think that the picture, the religious picture, since his administration has been quite different. Catholics have really been relieved of the burden of being regarded as outsiders in America in a way that they hadn't been previously.
Jonathan Miller, let's get you into the conversation here with some opening comments. As a politician, someone involved in politics all your life, writing a blog for recovering politicians and so forth, your overall sentiments about the presidency of John F. Kennedy, how did it influence you?
Well, you know, it's interesting that there's been so much focus this past week or so in the media, with the 50th anniversary of the assassination coming up. And with all the focus, there's been a natural backlash, a bunch of articles and stories written about, well, Kennedy wasn't that influential, his presidency was short, he gets too much credit for things like civil rights, et cetera. But I really do think that there are two very remarkable things that his influence on late 20th century, early 21st century politics cannot be overlooked. First of all, it is hard to underestimate how many people that are of my parents' generation and my generation who were inspired into public service by John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. And not just simply Democrats as well, but many Republicans have found him as, will cite him as one of the reasons why they got involved in, whether it's politics or in public service in more general. I think that a lot of it might have to do with their early death and their celebrity. But I think that Kennedy was really the first politician since Lincoln who was able to marry rhetoric with big ideas and with policy change. He used words, starting with his inaugural address, or maybe even starting with the speech he gave when he was running about being a Catholic, running for president. But throughout his presidency, was able to use words and big ideas to get people really excited, and symbols like going to the moon, and moments like the Cuban Missile Crisis that really made politics exciting, animated it, and made people like my father, and then passed down to me, excited about the idea of public service, and I think that still continues to today. The second thing that we can't underestimate is the impact of his assassination. And again, we're getting a lot of backlash. Oh, everyone's covering the assassination too much. Others every channel's got its own special. But to me, the assassination had an extraordinary impact, particularly on the baby boom generation and my generation, Generation X, which followed it. Because, you know, generational psychologists have taken a real good look at what makes a generation, what motivates a generation. And oftentimes there is a moment that happens that everyone in that generation remembers, and it carry it with them through their politics and their own personal lives. And for the greatest generation was Pearl Harbor, and how FDR the next day united the world against totalitarianism. And for my daughter's generation, our youngest generation, millennials, it was 9/11, and watching how, again, the world united to try to defeat terrorism and to help your neighbor, and those kinds of values and ideals were inculcated to those generations at a very deep level. But the baby boomers, of course, it was the Kennedy assassination, and so much of what they saw in that and during the weeks that followed were a real fear for their country, a real distrust of government. Still today, people don't believe the official story about how he was assassinated. That really led to an era that began with Vietnam and led through Watergate and still continues today, where and through the Tea Party today, where there is a very tremendous distrust of government, a cynicism of how government works. And so in that sense, I believe that the Kennedy assassination has had a lasting impact, not just simply it ended the life of a president who had tremendous potential, but it really changed the way a lot of people viewed politics, and it's kind of sad, and it's something that would be worthy for us always to reflect on.
Jonathan Miller and Carolyn DuPont are with us on this week's Eastern Standard. We're talking about the legacy of President John F. Kennedy. We're interested in your comments, your reactions, your observations about when you learned about President Kennedy's assassination. If you were around, tell us how that occurred for you. If not, how has the Kennedy legacy and Kennedy's presidency affected you, which we suspect that has done so anyway, despite the fact that you may not have been here during that time. We're opening the phone lines for you. We're interested in hearing from you. 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890. We also invite you to email us, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. We will be getting to listener calls and listener comments, as well as pursuing more on the Kennedy legacy during this week's Eastern Standard on 88.9 WEKU and the WEKU stations.
Everyone is voting for Jack, 'cause he's got what all the rest lack. Everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track, 'cause he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. 1960's the year for his high hopes.
This is Eastern Standard on WEKU. We are remembering the early 60s, Kennedy's election in 1960. A lot of high hopes there, Frank Sinatra singing of the hopes for Kennedy prior to the election. And of course, tomorrow, November 22nd, the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. We're interested in your stories of your experience of the Kennedy assassination. We actually asked listeners to interact with us or to send us their comments early in the week. We have one call that we recorded, someone who called in a couple of days ago, and we are interested in hearing from you, and we'll get to the phone line when we've got a few moments here, in just a few moments, after we continue our conversation with Carolyn DuPont and Jonathan Miller. Carolyn, talking again about the Kennedy legacy, and talking actually about Kennedy and Frank Sinatra, for instance, campaigning for him by recording a song. And I'm wondering if there were some parallels with the Obama election and the hopes that were there. Hope and change, high hopes. The parallels seem pretty strong in that regard.
Yeah, I think, you know, when Kennedy runs for the presidency in 1960, of course, he's running against Richard Nixon, who had been the vice president of Dwight Eisenhower. And Dwight Eisenhower, of course, you know, was an older president, and his administration was marked by, particularly with social issues, very inaction, really, kind of a passivity. And so Nixon can't escape the legacy of the administration he's been associated with. And so Kennedy certainly represents change from that more passive approach to governing and to domestic and foreign policy. And I think that, you know, he shares this with Obama. Both of them are charismatic. Both of them are youthful. Both of them represent constituencies that have never had someone in the White House before. As I mentioned before, Kennedy as a Catholic and President Obama as an African-American. So I think that there are certainly many parallels.
Jonathan Miller, I'm wondering if how you feel that Kennedy would be viewed if he had been elected in the current era with the media scrutiny and, of course, all the attention that's given to candidates with research before their candidacy is even announced. And, you know, of course, Kennedy's known sexual obsessions and so forth. Do you think he could have been elected in a world much like today's?
Well, I think he probably would have recognized that he would have had to behave different in a world like today. You know, it's a lot of it has been made about his sexual dalliances, but perhaps an even more important secret or a negative secret was how poor his health was. He was, you know, his back was, you know, wrenched. He was on a tremendous amount of medication. He had Addison's disease that he had to take medication for. He was a very sick man. And, you know, part of what we know of Kennedy as this good-looking, vigorous guy is the result of a lot of medication that was making him look that way. And so that was not known to very many people. And again, that would have been something that he would have had to deal with. But again, it's hard to bring someone from that era into this era. I think holding people to the standards of 2013 when it happened 50 years ago is a bit unfair. He was a bright guy, and all of us have flaws, and I think that he would have done his best to try to serve the country in a way, understanding what might have been exposed that he behaved as a 1963 person in 2013.
Carolyn DuPont, would you say Kennedy was ahead of his time, though, in terms of his awareness and ability to use the media? For instance, the debate with Mr. Nixon, where Mr. Kennedy was clearly prepared and ready for TV when Mr. Nixon had no idea what his appearance was going to mean to voters.
Well, I think certainly Kennedy used that debate much more to his advantage. He understood how to look look at an audience where Nixon didn't. So certainly he is much more skillful and just frankly more appealing in those ways.
I want to get one listener call on the air while Mr. Miller is still with us. We have on the line AJ from Hazard, Kentucky. AJ, thank you for calling. Tell us about your experience of the Kennedy assassination.
I think it was interesting. I was a student at Eastern at the time, and I also was in the marching band. Our director was Mr. Konenstein at the time, and we had rehearsal at 4 o'clock. And that was Friday afternoon. And Mr. Case said, at the beginning of the rehearsal, he said he was distressed and very upset about the situation, but in case they went ahead and had the football game on Saturday, we needed to be prepared. And this was our last chance to practice our marching routine for the football game. And so we went ahead and had band practice that afternoon. It was just a strange practice, I remember.
Hmm. I assume the game did not get played and you did not end up performing?
I don't remember.
Wow, the memory of that day, of course, so much stronger than the others.
Yes.
Well, that's very interesting, AJ. Thank you for sharing it. I mean, where were you at the time that the Kennedy's death was announced, around 1:30 Eastern time that day?
I had come back.
2:30, I guess it was.
I had come back from a psychology class to my dormitory. It was Case Hall at the time. And I went downstairs. We had one TV down in the rec room, down in the basement. So there were about 20 girls sitting around watching TV that afternoon. And that's when we heard the announcement.
All right. AJ, thank you for being part of our Eastern Standard program this week. Our phone number, 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890. We have an email we want to acknowledge in a few minutes. So we, as I mentioned, have a recorded phone call that we'll get to in a little bit. But and Jonathan Miller, we're just a few minutes remaining with you before we need to bring on another guest. But overall, your sense of what we can take from the Kennedy presidency. What does America, what does Kentucky learn, and how ultimately do we benefit from the Kennedy presidency, if we do?
You know, I do think he really has helped shape what we know as modern politics. I agree with his critics that I think we overblow the way that his presidency impacted public policy because he was there for so short, and because, you know, so many of the things we associate with Kennedy were actually implemented by his successor, Lyndon Johnson. But given that, it's hard to imagine Johnson being able to get things passed without having the example and the image and the memory of John Kennedy to help spur the tide, to let us continue work in his following. And then for the last 50 years, we've seen members of Kennedy's family, you know, be able to use that memory, whether it's his brother Bobby or brother Teddy or the next generation. Now we're in a third generation with his nephew or his would-be grandnephew in Congress, of people who've been able to use that legacy of JFK to do community and public service. And so while his presidency might not have lived up to the potential of his accomplishments, due mostly to the assassination, the legacy certainly continues to this day and continues to inspire politicians and recovering politicians to try to live up to the ideals and the rhetoric that he was a symbol of.
Before I let you go, let's talk briefly about no labels. I mean, would Mr. Kennedy have identified with your movement of no labels, which is attempting to perhaps reduce the absolute animosity, I guess, among the partisans of especially Democrats versus Republicans? Where would Mr. Kennedy stand on a movement of that type?
You know, I think anybody would like to claim Kennedy's mantle for their own movement, but his presidency certainly was a real indication of what we're trying to accomplish. I would even credit Ronald Reagan. Both of these men were very partisan during election seasons. They fought hard to get elected, and they spurred on their own partisan troops. But when they got into office, they made special efforts to try to reach out to the other side, to work the other side, to not try to demonize the other party as enemies or traitors. Unfortunately, these days, too many politicians hide behind their partisan bunkers and don't even seek out the other side for ideas. And so I think using a model like John Kennedy, who fought for tax cuts, who led a very bipartisan foreign policy, and who really worked with Republicans ultimately to lay the groundwork for the civil rights legislation that LBJ enacted. That's a model that No Labels is trying to bring back to the country. And, you know, if folks want to find out more about us, go to nolabels.org, and you can join our movement and help try to bring back this kind of era that John Kennedy symbolized years ago.
Some of our listeners might be interested in your Recovering Politician blog website as well. Jonathan Miller, co-founder of No Labels and attorney with Frost, Brown, and Todd in Lexington, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We remind you the phone lines are open at 800-621-8890. We'll continue with your comments and, of course, with Carolyn DuPont, as well as another guest who's going to join us in a few moments. But first, a man with close ties to Kentucky was charged with the task of announcing the death of President Kennedy on November 22, 1963. Malcolm Kilduff was an assistant press secretary to White House Press Secretary Pierre Salinger, who was out of the country. And although not a native Kentuckian, Kilduff adopted the state as his home, spending his later years in Beattyville in eastern Kentucky's Lee County. In an interview that we have reason to believe was done in 1979, Mr. Kilduff spoke with a young WEKU reporter, Ron Smith, who is now retired from his position here. He's been retired a couple of years now. But Ron Smith spoke with Malcolm Kilduff about Mr. Kilduff's experience in Dallas on the day President Kennedy died.
It was a friendly crowd. And here in the, really what we considered the seat of the far political right, being Dallas, Texas, instead we found the crowd friendly. As we formed up in the motorcade, I was in the third car. And as we drove down to the Trade Mart, we took a very circuitous route from Love Field to the Trade Mart. There was a shorter route, but politically, again, the decision was made to make a longer route and to swing around the city and to come up through the downtown area to give the crowd, and that would have been the noontime crowd, a better time to see the president and a better opportunity to see him. So that's precisely what we did. And those decisions were all made on a political base. Mm-hmm. They were not made by any secret group or anything of that sort. It was just a plain out-and-out political maneuver.
But the regular security precautions were taken.
Normal security precautions were taken. And as the motorcade proceeded, the crowd was good, as I said. And we came to the school book depository, and as I previously said, I looked up at the sign and I said, well, the name of God is the school book depository. And as we swung there on Elm Street, the first shot was fired. And my first thought was that this was around Thanksgiving. And fireworks are sold in Texas around Thanksgiving, as they are in a lot of Southwest areas. And then the second shot was fired. By that time, I had turned around and I was looking up in the window of the Texas School Book Depository, because being in the third car, the shots came directly over my right shoulder and above. And as we talk later, that will become more important. But I was turning around trying to see where the shots were coming from. By that time, the third shot had rung out, and we were starting to speed up, and the motorcade sped up. And we literally got out of there. But I could not see ahead, two cars ahead of me, to see what was going on in those cars.
How long was it between the time you heard the shots and when you realized what had really happened?
Not until we got to Parkland Hospital. I immediately saw what condition the president was in.
Did you think at that point he was dead because...
No, it didn't, you know, no. I figured, you know, he's really been hurt. I mean, the concept of the President of the United States dead? Of course not. And so at 1:31, I got up on what was a little platform in the nurse's instruction room in Parkland Hospital and made the announcement that John Kennedy was dead.
John F. Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time today here in Dallas.
A recording that is still difficult to hear for a variety of reasons. 50 years later, Malcolm Kilduff, the assistant press secretary who happened to be on duty on the day of President Kennedy's assassination. Mr. Kilduff died at the age of 75 in Beattyville, Kentucky, his wife Bonnie's hometown. And we have that entire 30-minute interview that Ron Smith did with Malcolm Kilduff on our website at weku.fm, so we encourage you to check that out when you get an opportunity to do so. This is Eastern Standard. 800-621-8890 is our phone number. Let me quickly acknowledge an email from Beverly, who wrote, I remember vividly the fall of 1962. It was October 8th, and I was 12 years old. All the people of our subdivision were gathered on the main road to watch President Kennedy and his motorcade go past as they came from the greater Cincinnati airport. It was exciting beyond words. We only got a glimpse of JFK as he went past and waved at all of us, but it was wonderful, and we were so hopeful about the future. It didn't matter if you were a Democrat or Republican. There was a great unity that has probably not been seen since. So sad to think that a little more than a year later, the remarkable life was snuffed out by an angry young man. A second is all it takes to change the course of history, but I believe that if we look back, we can glean much wisdom from those that have gone on before us. Beverly, very, very appropriate comments. Beverly from Waco, Kentucky, thank you for writing in to Eastern Standard at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Now, on the line, we have with us Mr. John J. Johnson, Executive Director of the Kentucky Human Rights Commission, a position he has held since 2007. Mr. Johnson became the youngest president of any NAACP chapter at the age of 18. And Mr. Johnson joins us for the duration of today's Eastern Standard program. Thank you so much, Mr. Johnson, for being with us.
Thank you for allowing me to participate.
Briefly, before we take a short station break, we'll certainly get back to you with more detail, but the role Mr. Kennedy played in furthering civil rights from your point of view with the perspective of history.
Well, it's interesting if you look at that period of time, what happened in 63. It was on April the 16th that Martin King wrote his famous letter from the Birmingham jail. It was in May of that year that Bull Connor, the sheriff down in Alabama, put dogs and fire hoses and on black demonstrators, and it was viewed all throughout the nation. It was that type of pressure that came about, that type of exposure that came about during that year that caused President Kennedy on June the 11th, if you will recall, to deliver a major civil rights speech. And that's the first time that the president had addressed the nation on these issues with the type of energy that the President Kennedy did. It just so happened that the following day, well, on June the 12th, was when Mega Evers, the field secretary for the NAACP, was killed in Jackson, Mississippi, during a voter registration drive, drove home that night, and an assassin was waiting in the bushes to kill him, shot him in the back.
Mr. Johnson, we're going to take a brief a pause here, and we're going to come back to you. You're making some very valuable and important points. We want to come back to you. Sorry for interrupting you. We want to come back and get back into 1963 as Eastern Standard continues. 800-621-8890 is our phone number.
Anybody here seen my old friend John? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed the good they die young. I just looked around and he's gone.
Thanks to that song, President Kennedy, of course, forever related to Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. We're talking about the assassination of President Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. And with us on the line is John Johnson, Executive Director of the Kentucky Human Rights Commission. I'm sorry for having to interrupt you there for our station break, but you're talking about the assassination of Medgar Evers, which happened just months prior to the assassination of President Kennedy.
Yes, and what I was saying was that the president had addressed the nation the day before Medgar was assassinated and made a passionate speech. The nation was beginning to relook at this whole issue of racism and discrimination, and people were rising up in righteous indignation to say that we have to change our society. And when the president addressed the nation on the 11th of June, people saw leadership from the White House that we had not seen before, and so people felt positive about that. But there were also people who hated to see those changes, who were not in agreement with it. And Mega's family, I worked for the National NAACP for 22 years and got to be very close friends with his wife and his family, but she often talks about the assassination that evening and how there's some feeling that because the president made this very passionate speech that some people just went the other way. It was on August the 28th of that year that the 63 March on Washington took place, where thousands of people came to the nation and demonstrated for a change in laws, you know, for the implementation of civil rights laws for jobs and justice and that sort of thing. And so that year was a lot of action. There was a lot of activity going on. By the way, I should share with you that the year following that, in 64, the next major demonstration took place right here in Frankfort, Kentucky, in March the 5th of 64, the march that created the State Human Rights Commission that I direct here as a result of that march. And on the 5th of March, 2014, will be the 50th anniversary. And so we hope we can come back at some point and talk to you about the things that we're doing for a major march we're planning for next year to coincide with that. But let me just go forward to share with you that the march on Washington on August the 28th, where most people will recall Martin King made his famous speech, I Have a Dream. He had made the speech several times before, but it never caught on. But at that particular moment, he made that speech during that rally in the nation's capital. And every child just about now in school can recite the I Have a Dream speech, if nothing else. But let me tell you just a couple other things. Just before Kennedy was killed, on September the 15th, four young girls were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Kids at Sunday school, man, and, you know, as Sunday school let out, they were waiting for the church to start coming out of Sunday school. And the bomb went off there in the church, killing four young girls. And that was the nation just couldn't believe the type of thing that was happening. And then on November the 22nd, the president was killed. People thought that for the first time the nation is going to move beyond this sort of thing, that we have at least in the White House a good and decent person who's willing to. He hadn't done all that we had hoped he would do or all we thought he should do, but at least he was beginning to scratch the surface and to call the nation's attention to move it in the right direction on race relations. And Lord, then his life was taken away. What do we do? And that was the kind of mood, I think, that the nation found itself in during that time. I didn't mean to talk so long.
That's okay. You're offering some very important observations and very welcomed. Carolyn DuPont, assistant professor of history at Eastern Kentucky University, is with us in the studio. Carolyn, do I get the sense that you don't quite agree with Mr. Johnson's assessment of Mr. Kennedy's support for civil rights?
No, it's not that I disagree at all. I think it's just important to understand where the impetus comes from for President Kennedy to speak out on behalf of Black Americans and to sponsor, to initiate legislation. And I'm not suggesting that Kennedy didn't have a real commitment to Black equality. He did. It's just that he had, his own party is divided on this issue. And Southern Democrats are a very important constituency that he wants to work with him. And Southern Democrats control many of the the chairmanships of committees in Congress. So he's reluctant until some of these things that happen to sponsor legislation. And I think another thing that's really important for us to keep in mind about Kennedy is that when Kennedy came to the presidency, his real love was foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And he wants America to win the Cold War. And you cannot really separate, as much as he would have liked to have been able to, the issue of civil rights from the Cold War, because the disturbances that Mr. Johnson just referred to, the assassination of Medgar Evers, the incredible events in Birmingham where dogs are set upon Black demonstrators, the Birmingham church bombing, and Mr. Johnson mentioned how that riveted the attention of the nation. It certainly did, but it also riveted international attention. And the Soviet Union and other communist regimes use those incidents to say, look, America is not the more open, democratic, and humane society that it claims to be. And certainly, as you have African nations that are making a bid for independence, and the Kennedy administration is very concerned about that they would tilt toward America rather than toward the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, of course, wants them to tilt toward them. And, you know, they point to those incidents, the Soviets do, and say, look how blacks are treated in America. How can you trust Americans? And so Kennedy really understands that domestic disturbances over civil rights have everything to do with how we're waging the Cold War. And this is a very important consideration in his mind when he takes the more proactive stance on civil rights that we see during the end of his administration.
Mr. Johnson, Executive Director of the Kentucky Human Rights Commission, do you feel that if Mr. Kennedy had lived, he would have accomplished the passage of the Civil Rights Act as President Johnson did?
Well, let me say first that I agree with everything that was just said. That's why I tried to preface my remarks by trying to say the conditions of the country, what we were confronted with at that time.
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't like that Kennedy had all this love in his heart. I mean, he may have, but what I believe pressured him to even make the speech on June the 11th was the fact that these other things were occurring in the country, and they were bringing the types of pressures to bear that somebody needed to speak out and say something. And most black people at that time said, Lord, maybe the president finally now realizes and maybe we can look to him for leadership. We all were hurt and saddened with the assassination. The truth of the matter is, though, the country after his assassination was willing to be more open and to move more aggressively on civil rights than I believe they would have been had he not been assassinated.
Wow, interesting.
Lyndon Johnson, who was a conservative, but who was able to shepherd through civil rights legislation, he never gets enough credit for what he did in my mind, but he was able to shepherd through and push for legislation that he would not have been able or even been encouraged to do short of the assassination, in my opinion.
Let's get to the phone and talk to one of our callers who's been waiting for some time. We hope that Brack is still on the line from Lexington. Brack, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead, Brack. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, I would like to disagree with Mr. Miller's assessment of the legacy of Mr. Kennedy's administration for two reasons. Number one, because the current global trade under the GATT and NAFTA treaties actually began during the Kennedy round economic talks in Europe, and that is a historical fact. You will find that in the history books. And the other reason I disagree with his assessment of the Kennedy administration's legacy, his lasting impact, is that the Department of State under Kennedy actually discussed the papal encyclicals Pacem in Terris, Peace on Earth, in which the Pope called for open borders, social and economic justice through distributing wealth to other nations through these multinational corporations, which then, by 40 years later, it took 40 years to incorporate all this into American public policy, but it was secretly discussed by the Kennedy Department of State. The Department of State employees remain there as the backbone of the government, and they continued to implement these during the subsequent presidencies, and even Republican presidents signed on to it.
Brack, thank you so much for your comments. Of course, referring to Mr. Jonathan Miller, who was with us earlier in the program. And we have another caller on the line, John from Georgetown, who has a question or a comment that really falls within the same line as where Brack was headed. John, thanks for calling. Go right ahead. Are you there, John? Apparently.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. You had some comments about Kennedy and his views about the Catholic Church?
Yeah, I had a question for Carol DuPont. I've often heard it said that among Protestants in the U.S., one of the last remaining acceptable biases or prejudices is an anti-Roman Catholic bias or prejudice. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, in the wake of the assassination and with the impact of Vatican II, What would be your thoughts on any of the impact of Catholic perceptions in the U.S. in the wake of Kennedy's presidency and how their relationships perhaps with Protestants over the next couple of decades?
And Vatican II, by the way, was the church council that happened right in that very era.
The 5 years.
In that very era, yes. I'll take the answer off the call. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, John.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that there are three things that sort of coincide to really help Catholics over overcome this stigma that they'd carried ever since really the early 19th century, when you start to see a lot of immigration into the United States of Catholics. And one would be John Kennedy's presidency, the fact that he was able to be elected. There was only one other time that a Catholic had run for president, and that was 1928, Al Smith, who was, of course, defeated disastrously. Vatican II, which, you know, enables the Mass to be said in the vernacular, softens the Church's stance on certain issues, and that sort of, you know, the Catholic Church, many Protestants reacted negatively to aspects of the Catholic Church because it seemed mysterious to them. And one of the things was saying the Mass in Latin. You know, Protestants are really all about a gospel that you can understand. And, of course, if you can't understand the priest because he's speaking in Latin, that just didn't make sense to Protestants. And so that and other reforms from Vatican II, I think, also helped. But also, I think, the Cold War, because when America was positioning itself as, you know, the real enemy of democracy is communism, and so that's America's number one enemy during the Cold War. And that is an opposition that Catholics could point to that they had also shared. Catholics had also been very important and vigorous enemies of communism. And this is a place where the interests of the Catholic Church and the interest of America's political interests really come together. And I think that that helps a lot of Americans drop some of that prejudice. And I will also say that a lot of that prejudice tended to be in the South. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's the area of the country that was that most disliked Kennedy anyway.
Prejudice against blacks, prejudice against Catholics, prejudice against blacks. Mr. Johnson of the Kentucky Human Rights Commission, parallels there with, for instance, did the Kennedy presidency open the way for the Obama presidency?
Well, I guess we could go back and say, you know, the Eisenhower administration or other administrations, maybe the Truman administration, in terms of segregation of the military, all of these things had, you know, impacts toward the change that we see today. But I, certainly the Kennedy administration and what he was trying to do near the end of his life helped put in place a momentum for continuous social change. I think people shouldn't assume that all is well even today. Even with a black man in the White House doesn't mean that we still don't have issues of discrimination and poverty, certainly in this state, one of the poorest states in the nation, issues related to education and other social and economic issues that we need to be addressing to talk about true equality.
Okay, we've asked listeners to tell about where you were the day President Kennedy was assassinated, and Lewis is on the line from Lexington. Lewis, thank you for, Lewis was on and then apparently is no longer on the line. We are wrapping up today's program discussing the assassination of President Kennedy and the legacy of President Kennedy. John Johnson, once again, your overall assessment, how did the Kennedy presidency change the America that we live in today, or the Kentucky that we live in today?
Well, I really think that the Kennedy administration, at least for his impact in the area of civil rights, human rights, social justice issues, that the ball began to move a little faster in that administration, not suggesting at all that Kennedy did everything that we thought he should do. The NAACP's Clarence Mitchell, who was the lobbyist for the NAACP before there was a Congressional Black Caucus and that sort of thing, had worked extremely hard on legislation over the years. But Kennedy's administration did put into place a momentum that continues even today.
Carolyn DuPont?
Yeah, I think that Mr. Johnson is right about that. I think that we can somehow, we can measure the impact that Kennedy had in part by reactions to his death in those pockets of the Deep South that were very, very much dominated by segregationists. And that's, when I say pockets, I don't mean small pockets. I should perhaps say large swaths. When Kennedy was assassinated, of course, you know, all the programs that we're watching during this week that are remembering that assassination are showing us a nation in mourning. But there are significant places in the South where people celebrated, and I think that's very hard for us to hear. But it was not the mood of somber reflection and sadness. Particularly in the state of Mississippi, they were very angry with Kennedy, not only for his sponsorship of a civil rights bill, but also because in 1962, Kennedy had sent in the army to quell a riot at the University of Mississippi when James Meredith was integrating it. So, you know, he's really a big enemy to segregationists. And I think that that in it of itself suggests that his actions were of consequence, that they did make a difference.
Carolyn DuPont, Assistant Professor of History at Eastern Kentucky University, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And John Johnson, Executive Director of the Kentucky Human Rights Commission. Sorry, we are out of time, but yeah, I think we will talk with you. We'll stay in touch about the commemoration of the Frankfurt activities as that develops. Please stay in touch with us about that.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Eastern Standard is a production of the WEKU stations at Eastern Kentucky University. This program is available as a podcast from our website at weku.fm. And we do want to remind you that that 30-minute interview that former WEKU reporter Ron Smith did with Malcolm Kilduff about his role in announcing the death of President Kennedy, that is on the website at weku.fm. Our associate producers are Andrew Moorhead and Richard Turner. Our technical director is Jonice Franklin. We do remind you this show will also be available online. It'll actually later today. Give us a few hours, and before the end of the business day, you'll find this program posted at weku.fm. We're interested in hearing from you anytime with comments, topics, guest suggestions. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm John Hingsbergen.